Billy Galloway is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas has given up public hangings, but stay to witness the legal homicide of Billy Galloway by lethal injection in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Robert Rosenberg, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Dennis Longmire, Austin visual reporter Darnelius Perez, and a special guest Esteban Garcia, ex-convict, ex-heroin addict, and author of the United States Jailhouse Lawyer's Manual. The Execution Watch begins. Don't you know they're killing people? 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 Don't you know they're
This is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT Houston HD2 channel, or you may be taking it off the internet on the World Wide Web at www.executionwatch.org. Tonight they've scheduled the execution of Billy John Galloway. He was condemned for a murder in Greenville, Texas, just east of Dallas, during a 1998 robbery in which he was joined by Kevin Varga. Kevin was killed last night, and they had two women companions. The women pled guilty to lesser charges, and their testimony may have been used in either or both of these cases. We will find all of that out later when we talk about the legal history of this case with Robert Rosenberg, a Houston attorney. My name is Ray Hill. I am the host of The Prison Show on Friday nights on KPFT Houston Broadcast and HD1 channel. Tonight we're going to have an old friend of The Prison Show, Esteban Rogelio Garcia. Esteban is a former inmate and an author of a couple of books, and a legal writer and a consultant, and Esteban and I visit frequently. The first guest voice you're going to have is going to be Dr. Dennis Longmire, who is a professor at the College of Criminal Justice at Sam Houston State, and I can tell by Elizabeth's movements that it is time to talk to Dennis. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Ray.
You're on the air.
Okay, well.
Okay, tell us what's going on there in Huntsville.
All of the witnesses have entered the building. As a matter of fact, just before I received this phone call, five witnesses for the condemned entered the building. Just prior to that, witnesses who are members of the media had entered. And so the execution is going forward. I do not know who the people were who went in to witness on behalf of Mr. Galloway, except, again, Catherine Cox.
Catherine Cox, yeah.
She was here last night, and she's also gone in again tonight. So she must have been providing spiritual counseling for both of the offenders that we're executing.
Yes, Catherine Cox is with Salvation Army. She's a commander, former commander, and her territory is provide spiritual counseling for people on death row, and she's been doing that for more years than I can recount.
Exactly. I've seen her many, many times, and I always know that when she's going in, the men are prepared for the horror that we're about to put them through, because she does a very, very good job calming them and getting them ready.
Are there vigilants?
There are five of us on the corner. There are two women from Austin who were also here last night.
Mm-hmm.
They are affiliated with the Austin chapter of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And then myself and two other regular vigilants, I guess, is what we are.
Well, I will actually later in this program visit Darnie Perez, who is the organizer of the Austin Vigil. So tell them that are there that we're glad that they made it all the way over to Huntsville, but we will be covering the vigil that happens in Austin in their absence.
Very good. I will do that.
Okay. Well, if anything happens that we should know about, you'll notify Elizabeth, and we'll talk to you later in the program, Dennis.
Okay.
That is what you say the process has begun. When the witnesses have crossed the road, there is a very good chance that the executions proceeded, it's still possible at this late hour for some governor or some judge to interrupt the proceedings right up until the moment before they put the injection to work. But that happens very, very rarely, so we can only assume that the process is continuing. Here in the studio, I've got Robert Rosenberg, a Houston attorney who's joined us again. Robert and I have done this show before. Robert, what can you tell us about this case?
Well, it is really what I've looked at is the habeas record, and which are the constitutional violation claims. In this case, it was basically limited to ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think this case is one of those situations that I have mentioned before where I believe that the facts dictate the outcome rather than the law dictating the outcome.
Yeah, this is not a pretty case.
No, it's not. Mr. Galloway and Mr. Vargas were not very nice people.
They were from somewhere else, North Dakota.
North Dakota,
and they came down here kind of on a crime spree.
They did. They killed somebody on their way here, and then they killed the fellow in Greenville. Was it Greenville.
Greenville. Have you ever been to Greenville?
I don't know.
Greenville is a pretty serious a conservative religious fundamentalist town east of Dallas. I've been there. Back whenever I was a kid, I was a member of the Oddfellows Lodge of Texas, and
weren't
I was the grand
looking?
Chief ruler. And so I went there and did degree work. In the late 50s, they still had a sign using the N-word suggesting that no one that applied to should let the sun set on their behind.
Well, then Mr. Galloway would have been welcome there, probably. He didn't know it because he had been a white supremacist when he was in prison in North Dakota.
Right. And so, so actually, Greenville's kind of a magnet for those folks. They started in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is where began their journey. They went to Wichita, Kansas. I think that one of the newspaper reports that I read indicated that basically the women with them were supposed to lure men having resources.
That's what you get from reading the case, you know,
yeah.
The opinions.
And then they were going to rob them, and all of that was not very well thought out, which gave me indication there may have been some drugs or a great deal of alcohol involved.
I got the impression.
A little closer to that microphone. It worked.
I got the impression from reading about the cases that they were drug-induced. A drug-induced crime spree, they had just been released. I think they'd just been released from prison in, I guess, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And they had buddied up in prison. And the warden of the prison up there actually had said that Mr. Vargas was a negative influence on Mr. Galloway. And Mr. Galloway's attorneys had a discussion with the warden about coming to Texas to testify on his behalf, but they didn't do it. And why I said it really seems like rather than following the law, the courts have ignored his efforts to overturn his, probably couldn't overturn his conviction because I don't think there was much doubt that he was guilty of the crimes, but to overturn his sentence. And that is that his lawyers didn't put on any mitigation case, and the law should be very clear that a lawyer has a duty to conduct a thorough investigation into the defendant's mm-hmm. background. And then put forth evidence that might mitigate against the death penalty. And in this case, the lawyers couldn't even recall if they had a discussion about what kind of mitigation case they should put on. And one of the lawyers said that he in the 90s, it became popular to hire what's called a mitigation specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I've never really understood exactly what a mitigation specialist was as distinguished from the job the attorney should do and the job the private investigator should do. But a lot of times they're like social workers or sort of psychologist type people, and they are supposed to collect all the information and then process it and put it into a coherent story, which tells the defendants, you know, makes the defendant more sympathetic and portrays their life story to the jury, who then might empathize with the defendant and not vote for death.
Well, that sounds like a combination of things. I mean, wouldn't that be important during voir dire as well as the presentation?
Well, it would, but I mean, in the cases I've worked on where there's been a mitigation specialist and a private investigator, it seems like they were hired to fulfill the mandate of
the requirements,
sure. And not really,
sure.
And
I mean,
not really used.
They didn't bring anything to the table, but they got paid, and it looks good.
Well, and the lawyers really don't even know how to use them.
Okay.
I'm sure there are excellent mitigation specialists out there. In fact, I know a fellow who I haven't worked with him, but he used to be a reporter here, and won an Emmy for a documentary he did for PBS, and he moved to Kansas City, and he's now a mitigation specialist, and I have no doubt that he's excellent at what he does.
Now, this
but I think he's probably special.
This is a 1998 case, so the homicide itself happened in 1998.
Yeah.
The trial happened soon thereafter. They don't mess around in Greenville, Texas. They usually get to business pretty quickly.
Well, was this tried in Dallas County or in... some other county.
Well, Greenville is not in Dallas
County.
Okay. But if you got just a transfer of venue, the easiest thing to do would be to try it in a city the size of Dallas,
right,
where you could commute.
You know, from what I read about his lawyers, I doubt that they bothered too much.
Then this was probably tried in Greenville.
You know, if a lawyer can't even recall having a conversation with his co-counsel about what kind of mitigation case they might put on, chances are they didn't really...
Robert, is that unusual in these small towns?
I'm not sure it's even unusual in big cities like Houston. I worked on a case where the two lawyers who had represented the guy at trial clearly had not communicated at all, and that one of them didn't even know that the other one had my client's medical records before the trial.
How, you know, I this is not a pretty case. I mean, this is a serious case, and there's a trail of blood that goes somewhere up in the Midwest where it gets really cold, and that goes on in this case. What are the chances of people basically on the lam getting any kind of trial with a positive result in a rural county like Greenville, Texas, in this state?
I don't understand why you're making a distinction between a rural small town and a big city.
That's exactly the answer that I was hoping I would get. And would you expound?
I believe after doing this since 1988 and reading the paper on a daily basis and living in other parts of the country for the last 7 years, I believe that the people of Texas don't really understand the concept of innocent until proven guilty. I believe that their understanding of the concept is innocent until a suspect, sort of what I call the Nancy Grace School of Justice.
Sure.
And it's enough to be the, you know, husband of a missing pretty young white woman to be, to be guilty of her murder, even if she happens to be alive and ran away from Georgia to get, you know, because she didn't want to get married. So, anyway, I really just don't think that it takes much to convict anybody in Texas, and in particular in Houston. I don't think it takes much to convict them. I think the jury is predisposed to convicting people when they go through the voir dire process of picking the jury, if you say that you're opposed to the death penalty, then you are disqualified from the jury serving as a juror. So the reason that they charge the death penalty so often, or they hadn't really charged the death penalty that much in the last few years in Houston, but the reason they used to do it all the time was because they wanted a death-qualified
jury
because they knew they'd get a conviction.
And then they withdrew the death thing.
Right. And you know, they'd still get a conviction because they had a jury that said, yes, we have no problem with the death penalty. But I also believe that the judges in many parts of the state view their role as basically an arm of the prosecution.
Well, a lot of them are former prosecutors in Harris County right now.
Yes, they are.
And, the lion's share, we got rid of a few of the prosecutors in judge dresses 2 years ago, and I hope we'll get rid of some more.
But until
year.
2 years ago, I believe there was only one judge who had not been a prosecutor. And
yeah.
When they were...
Yeah, Johnny Holmes used to get to pick the judges. That was
He did. Sure. He appointed the... I mean, people thought they were voting on them, but they had been selected by Johnny Holmes. So...
That's me.
Anyway, I think that's... but, you know, Ray, even in the case where you have really nasty facts, like Mr. Galloway's case, in other jurisdictions... people where they're not so determined to send people to death row take a person like Mr. Galloway, and if their life story is told completely.
Robert, I have a theory that we never execute the person who committed the crime anyway. I was reading John Grasick's report from last night's execution, Mr. Galloway's fall partner, the person
Vargas,
Mr. Vargas. The fact of the matter is, when it came time to his farewell address to his family and to the victims, he was quite articulate and gracious, and he's had. 11 or 12 years on death row, to dry out, to get rid of the chemicals, and to become an entirely different person.
Well, if I could just add something, Ray, a friend of mine actually, who has a relative on death row, became acquainted with Kevin Vargas before he was executed and was very impressed with his compassion and the fact that he, was very intelligent, had educated himself when he was behind bars. Not that this mitigates his crime in any way, but it does suggest that maybe he didn't deserve the death penalty. And Robert, I wanted to ask you, when we talk about mitigation, isn't that designed to help protect someone from cruel and unusual punishment? Isn't that an Eighth Amendment right?
I mean, that's the idea, that the jury should consider the entire person. And during the 80s and first part of the 90s, there was several cases that were sort of on the other side, which was whether or not what's called victim impact testimony could come in. And the discussion was, well, the case really isn't about the victim in the case. You know, the punishment is not supposed to be about the victim. It's supposed to be about the perpetrator of the crime. And in order to properly assess what the punishment should be, you shouldn't really look at whether or not the victim was a fine, upstanding person or, one of the most despicable people in the community. It's what,
which if they were, wouldn't come out in a victim's impact statement, because that is structured quite differently.
It is, but if they put it on, then the defense could raise some of those questions if the judge allows it. But then the judge could always say, well, I'm not going to allow that, and that happens. There was a brief period of time when the Supreme Court said that you couldn't have victim impact statement and income victim impact testimony. By the time Vargas and Galloway were tried, victim impact testimony was allowed, and in fact, one of the reasons that the defense lawyers at trial said that they didn't want to put on mitigation cases because they didn't want to open the door to victim impact testimony. But what also happened was the state put on victim impact testimony, and they were completely unprepared because they hadn't even put together a mitigation case. So the only side of the story that the jury heard was that
it's the same jury. Sentencing and guilt and innocence, same jury.
So anyway, I don't... I think, you know, one of the things that makes Mr. Galloway's case a little bit different than what would happen here is that in the federal court, there was actually a hearing, or there was discovery allowed, where the defense lawyers were questioned, you know, under oath about what happens in these cases with a ineffective assistance claim, at least in Houston. Is the defendant, you know, or the convicted person files their habeas petition and they say that the defense lawyers failed in this way, this way, this way, this way, and this way. You know, 15 ways maybe. 20 ways. Different cases, different ways. And then the DA calls up the defense lawyers who handled the trial and say, I need an affidavit from you. I'll prepare it and then you can come over and read it and sign it. And usually, if the defendant has raised 30 points of problems with what the lawyers didn't do, let's say they didn't interview witnesses, and they didn't interview this person and that person, they didn't get school records, they didn't, get medical records, whatever. The affidavits will be cursory at best, and they're totally self-serving because if a lawyer is found to have committed ineffective assistance to counsel, then they are dropped from the list of qualified attorneys to handle any more death cases, which is a big hit for them. So they have no, their incentive is to make sure that the state wins.
I've got Dennis back on the air. Okay. Dennis, what have you to report?
Well, the citizens of Texas can rest easy again tonight. We have executed another potentially violent offender, so we're all safe. The witnesses are literally crossing the street as we speak, coming back out of the prison, and so the execution is over.
Dennis, were you there last night?
Yes, I was.
Can you compare and contrast what happened last night, what happened tonight?
Well, I mean, in terms of the actual execution walk, as I call it, the march of witnesses, virtually the same thing happened last night as happened tonight. The difference tonight is that tonight there are five of us on the corner. Last night there were 12. Why the difference is unpredictable. I can't explain it.
Mm-hmm.
The university is out. Exams are taking place now.
Yeah.
Possibly that might account for some of it. But I've never quite figured out how to anticipate the activity here on the corner in terms of the opposition activity. But that's the only real difference that I can speak to.
Well, executions have picked up a pace. Our next execution is going to be a Rogelio Canade, and that's going to be on May the 19th, which is right around the corner.
Correct, yes. We are rapidly making progress, if that's what this is called.
Well, they've got to finish them up before the summer vacation of the Supreme Court. There's usually a 2-month period where
there are none
don't have executions, so the judges aren't disturbed on their vacation.
I heard that, and that's an interesting theory. We'll have to see if that holds true.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dennis Longmire, for your vigilance.
Oh, you're welcome.
And that, again, was Dennis Longmire. He's a professor at Sam Houston University. I was up there last week giving a discussion with a class in Jerry Bruce's history of psychology course. And we, John Endo and I, which do that lecture every semester, had a lot of questions about why Texas persists on the death penalty, and that was coming from students at Sam Houston, which I thought was interesting.
Were they for or against?
Oh, they seemed to be against, and otherwise they wouldn't have asked the question why are we doing this?
They would have just said it's a good thing.
Right, they might have made a declaratory statement.
Well, you know, in terms of mitigation, I mean, this case is really about a mitigation. It's a mitigation case.
Do we know that? I mean, what do we know from the record that indicated there were mitigating circumstances?
Well, they're always mitigating the circumstances. I mean, whatever it may be, I don't think that, you know, even as beautiful of a childhood as Ted Bundy's mother insisted that he had, I believe if one looked a little bit closer at what went on in the Bundy household.
Well, we had the warden's testimony that the other fellow was perhaps a negative influence on this guy.
Well, sure, but, I mean, how does... How does somebody get to be, I don't know. I mean, I'm a believer that you know, I believe you can meet kids that are 4 or 5 years old and say that kid is either going to be dead by the time they're 20 years old or they're probably going to be on death row.
Mm-hmm.
Because you look at the family and you look at the probably untreated ADD or whatever is going on with the kid, and you say, well, that kid is going to be in trouble some way or another.
Okay, Robert, we're going to go to Austin, Texas, to Saint Ignatius Martyr Catholic Church in Austin, and Darnelius Perez. Darnie, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Tell us what's going on over there. By the way, we are obliged to report that the process is complete. Billy John Galloway was killed by the state of Texas only moments ago. He is being transported to the funeral home where family members may touch him while there is still warmth in the body. I'm sorry to bring you that bad news, but tell us what's going on in Austin.
Well, we've just finished our vigil. A couple of members from some of the ministries at our church got together, and we prayed the rosary, which consists of the Lord's Prayer and another prayer called the Hail Mary, along with a few others. But it's a prayer of meditation, so it gave us the opportunity to reflect on the event, today's events, and also to lift them up in prayer.
How many folks did you have with you?
We had about 5 in attendance.
Okay, that's about the same number that were outside the death chamber in Huntsville. And I would like to remind the audience that there were also vigils here in Houston, in Brownsville that we know of, and perhaps other locations around the state, because this is a pattern that happens and I hope will continue to happen as long as Texas persists in executing people. How did you get involved in this issue, Darnie?
Well, we basically wanted to raise awareness amongst our church community of the death row executions, and so I figured a great way would be to pray for the death row inmate and their victims and families, but also to kind of get our other parishioners involved and make them aware of the death row executions.
Well, we appreciate the work that you do, and thank you for being a guest on the Prison Execution Watch tonight.
No problem. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
One doesn't really know what to say. Response from Darnie after my thanking him for being was that it was a pleasure to be on the radio. But
I thought that was an odd remark.
Well, it's not a usual thing that you would find pleasure in, and I'm sure he didn't actually mean that literally.
I think he meant it might have been a pleasure to speak
to you. Get a little closer to that microphone.
I think he might have meant it was a pleasure to speak to you rather than the occasion being a pleasure to have.
Yeah, this business, and you know, I wasn't here last night. Other folks besides Robert and I were in here doing last night's execution watch because I was in Huntsville. And I was speaking before prison gangsters. Texas prison system has a...
Were those guards or prisoners?
Well, all of the above, actually. There is a way to get out of prison gangs and guards and inmates. There's only one society, and so everybody is in and out of all of that. But these are the inmates most of whom, according to their supervisor, are there for gang-related homicides in the world or in prison. There was a room full of pretty tough-looking, kind of scary-looking guys. And I went in and, to celebrate with them the completion of the GRAD program. That's gang rejection. I don't know what the other two letters in the acronym are about, but they are now being moved from solitary confinement 23 hours a day to general population because they have finished the program, and this was their last meeting.
Mm.
And those are the folks that did not get execution. They got prison time, and some of them got a lot of prison time.
Well, you know, you wonder why. Because they're just as violent. I mean, what has always puzzled me in this business is that you have, let's say, gang members. You have two extremely violent gang members. They're both involved in murders.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, the prosecutor opts not to prosecute one of them for, you know, and seek the death penalty. The other one, they do.
Well,
and the truth is, I don't know. I mean, my experience with people on death row, and this isn't true of everybody on death row, of course, but, you know, you were talking about Mr. Vargas and how in the last 12 years when he's been on death row, he sort of reformed his life. And once he was off drugs and out of the chaotic world that he lived in the free world, or even in prison, but not on death row, he became an educated person. He became a thoughtful person. He became a person that other people like to be around.
And from Grazik's article, he was quite articulate.
And I think that probably most of those gang members who were at the graduation ceremony yesterday, I'll bet you that they really hadn't given up the gang.
Well,
life.
one of the gang guys there. No. Robert.
I hate to be cynical about it, but I just don't believe it.
Well, you sound like prison guard because the guards keep telling me no, these guys are faking it till they make it and all of that.
I would say it for a different reason.
Except that I have designed this program. I've worked with it for the decade that it's been around.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the fellows now it's a recovery style meeting, so I cannot mm-hmm. identify. We haven't been able. We can't reach Esteban. Is the question okay? Esteban is not reachable, and he was going to be our guest for a good part of the thing. So you and I've got a lot to talk about.
Oh
here,
my goodness!
So let's just take
I've got
off.
To talk to you for 25 more minutes.
Let's take off here at least. Now the deal is that one of the fellows there had been on death row on two separate occasions.
Mm-hmm.
He went to death row as a very young man. That case was turned over. And he was ultimately paroled out on the resulting, in those days, if you had been sentenced to death and you got your sentence commuted to life, that's 20-year life.
Right.
You got out, and he got out, and then he came back with a second death sentence. And now he is graduating from the grad program, and because his second execution case was overturned because of legal errors made in the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy has had, what is this now, his third bite at the apple.
He has been incredibly lucky.
He's been incredibly lucky. And not only is he incredibly lucky, he was the one person in the room with whom I was able to carry on quite an intellectual discussion with, because he had been around the block, and he and I bonded early in the meeting, and we discussed some things. And he's very interested in politics. He's very interested in keeping his family out of the mess that gangs can make of you. As a matter of fact, one of the guys after the meeting came up and introduced him to myself on what you call an amends principle, a ninth step, making amends for what you did whenever you were an addict. And he had voted to put a contract to have me killed. About 10 years ago. And so he came up, and I said, well, I will accept your apology for that. We'll make amends on that, but you've got to accept my apology because I have shamelessly exploited that story.
Really? You?
Well, the Houston Police Department called me and said that the Aryan Brotherhood put a hit on me.
You know, if he'd gone to dinner with the guy, he probably wouldn't have.
That's true. That's true. Or if I just winked at him in the crowd.
Instead, you were sitting over there with your sister.
But you see, I am very optimistic.
Right.
About these guys that yes, they have had horrible backgrounds and all that, but I am optimistic that these guys can overcome all of that.
Right. I agree with you.
Now,
when they're on death row and they have a very regimented lifestyle, and my clients, I say to people, you know, people, when they find out I represent people on death row, they go, oh, that must be so depressing. What horrible people. And I have often said, well, I'm fortunate in that I don't get I hate to say it, but the Galloways of the world, I guess. I mean, I didn't meet him, so he may have been okay person, but just from the facts, reading the facts, sounds pretty vicious. You know, or maybe because I know him, I feel like they're not such horrible, despicable people, and they have a story that, I can not relate to, but at least feel empathy for and understand how they ended up where they are. But what I do recognize is that being in the regimented lifestyle of death row, probably many of them could deal with even less regimentation, but in prison, they're taken out of having to make a lot of life choices, especially on death row.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't have pressures on them that may have led them to self-medicate and become mm-hmm. drug addicts or alcoholics,
mm-hmm.
homeless, desperate, mm-hmm. whatever it is that led them to engage in the behavior that ultimately led them to kill somebody in a fairly violent way that prompted the prosecutors to want to go after the death sentence. And when they're removed from that life that they had before the crime, they become much more peaceful. And I think Dr. Longmire would tell you that, I mean, I know he would because I've read testimony from cases he's testified in, that people on death row tend to be the least violent people in prison. Well, of course they're the least violent people in prison because they don't even have ability to engage in violence, although we say that and the prison says that. But it wasn't, you know, a couple of years ago I was visiting one of my clients on death row and he pointed to a woman and a baby, and it turns out she'd been a prison guard and had started a relationship with a death row inmate and got pregnant by him and was visiting him in prison after she, of course, got fired from delivering the child. But in any case, I mean, why I say that these people will probably, many of them, some of them will not go back to gang, but lifestyle, but the forces to be in a gang are still present, and to get by and survive, many of the people who go through this grad program may likely end up back in the gang.
Robert, I went to prison after a life of crime. I was a burglar. I was a successful burglar. I did well in that, but the retirement system sucked, and I took full retirement in 1970. And I got out of prison, and instead of getting better, I got worse. I went into politics.
Uh-huh.
And I hear what you're saying, but I know...
Right, not to diminish your life story and your prison experience.
No. I know because of my staff on the prison show. People who have left the gangs, completed their time, got out, maybe married women by proxy while they were in prison, maybe not, but have reasonably successful, although difficult lives because of discrimination about the number thing.
I'm not saying everyone who goes through the grad program will fail. What I'm saying is that the forces are still present.
That's the harps of heaven.
That in order to survive on a daily basis, many of them may not succeed, which is fine. I mean, and then they can go back to it. And, you know, you have, you know, this long life crime that you describe.
Sure.
And, but, you know, you describe yourself as a very successful burglar.
I am. I mean, I'm just
Well,
true.
The difference between...
I made a lot of money in that business.
The difference between
you... I haven't
you,
made that kind of money since.
The difference between you and Mr. Galloway are most people on death row who tried to be criminals... Is they weren't as smart as you, right. And they didn't know how to do it.
His plan didn't work. I understand that.
You know, you didn't end up, you know, taking a gun into somebody's house, not realizing that they come home every day.
You know, I was
for lunch.
I got a call.
And you decide, well, you know, what time I'm going to break into the house with my gun? I'm going to break in at 5 minutes before they come home every day. And what am I going to do when they get there? Oh my goodness, I'm going to shoot them. Because what else would I do? Well, you knew better than that. You were a successful criminal.
Right. So, I was 5 minutes after they left, not 5 minutes
right,
before they
Right, you waited until they left.
Right.
You didn't wait till they were coming
and
home.
And I didn't have any guns. And But the deal is, for instance, I got a call yesterday, a prepaid call from a prison, and it was a lawyer friend of, I'm sure you know the lawyer. He's now doing time in Texas, and he wanted me to hook him up with a bondsman. I said, it's a little late for a bondsman, isn't it? No, but
well,
he's
so screwed up, he didn't even know that, did he, right?
they haven't let bail bondsmen cut people's time yet.
I don't,
not
know,
in prison, in
I
jail
mean, since
yet.
We're a little bit off point, maybe you have given this some thought. When you go, this has always puzzled me since they moved to the prison, the death row to Livingston from Huntsville.
Sure.
Have you been? I mean, I don't know how often you go to death row.
I was on Ellis yesterday, and I've been on death row. I was actually in the section of Ellis that was death row.
I'm talking about Polunsky.
And now I've been to Polunsky behind the curtain. I've actually walked into the cell block where people actually live during the time they were there.
So you went through the booth.
Yeah.
The guard house.
Sure.
Well, do you remember when they first put death row there? They had a metal detector that you were supposed to walk through with a table next to the metal detector where you put your briefcase. And there was nobody who looked in your briefcase.
That's right.
It took them years
to figure out
that, oh, if they're going to carry a gun inside the prison, then we should check the briefcase.
Yes.
And now they, you know, make you basically strip down for whatever. But even more absurd than that, what has always bothered me, and I was wondering what your thoughts might be, is the sign that's on the door. The first big steel door. Do you remember what it says?
No.
It says, hostages will not be allowed to exit through this door.
Okay. Right. You have to use another door if you're a hostage.
And, you know, after going there for several years and looking at that sign, I finally said to the woman who's sitting there in the guard booth, this was before there were any other guards there, what does that sign mean? If I'm taken hostage... And the prisoner says, okay, he's coming out through the front gate. Are y'all going to say, no, he can't?
That's right. We got a rule that he can't.
I'm sorry, he has to come out through the back gate. I said, you know, the prisoner doesn't even know that that sign is on that gate because they've never been
there.
Well,
they will
when
they get there. And they say, oh, we can't go this way.
It doesn't say prisoners can't go through that door.
No.
It says hostages can't go through that door.
If he's got a hostage with him, he can't go that way.
She said hostages will be shot if they try to come through that door.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, I guess I'll bring it up because you're talking about this, you know, we're having a discussion on whether or not people will revert to gang life. And before the show started, I was asking you whether or not there's been a dramatic drop in prison rapes since the Prison Elimination Act of 2005, which I think is just one of the most absurd names for any kind of law.
We had a program to address the problem of prison rapes, and it was staffed by inmates. I mean, educational system in prison is the same as educational system in any society. The older, more experienced people teach the younger, less experienced people.
I understand that, but who that's on the prisoner side of the equation. But on the other side is the management and guard system, where the guards and the warden and everybody in between are dependent on prison gangs operating. Mm-hmm. They are dependent on certain levels of prisoner-on-prisoner violence. They are dependent on certain employer, you know, employee prison violence. And until you can try to teach the prisoners all you, you know,
you have correctly tagged it that rape in prison is not a sexual thing. It is a dominance and a violence.
As is the gang business.
And assaulted. And gangs are nurturing atmospheres for that.
Not just the rapes, but everything. Everything is a hierarchy, be it, you know, through gang violence and you know, having sex slaves or slaves that aren't for sex, but for other tasks that might be necessary, to guards encouraging, okay, you know, fighting out on the yard so that the people come back worn
Robert,
out.
Robert, we're going to have to interrupt this. This is because my good friend Esteban Garcia has found. Esteban, you're hard to find when I need you.
Yes, sir. Sometimes I am, but I
yeah, well, you've got to fix that if we're going to schedule a program. The last time you came on the prison show, you came well after the program began, and I don't put up with that.
You're right.
And so when I needed to reach you for this show, you were not available, but I am thankful that we have you now, although our conversation is going to be considerably shorter than it would have been had we been able to reach you when we had you scheduled.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so do you know anything about tonight's execution or perhaps the next execution scheduled?
Well, I know that there was an execution tonight, and like always, you know, it saddens me that, you know, we've taken another human life, and like many others, you know, that have been put to death that haven't had a chance to be exonerated because of one thing or another. But I believe that I've pretty much read as much as I want to read as far as people who have been exonerated from death row because of DNA. And it just saddens me because the state, you know, when something like this happens, all they can say to the victim is that they're sorry. And that's a sad thing to know that we continue to execute people without really knowing whether they're guilty or innocent. And even if they were, the idea of executing people is a little barbaric to me.
Esteban, as a jailhouse lawyer, and that's what you did when you were in prison a lot, is you help people in the writ room, did you have the opportunity to work with people on death row?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that.
In fact, when I was in federal prison in El Reno, they had a transit unit where people were coming through. They were going off to death row. And I was their barber. And so sitting there and cutting their hair and listening to their stories, you know, of course, you don't know which guys, you know, are telling the truth, which guys aren't. But some of them are so sad that you can't help but just feel sorry for the person because, you know, there's something about when a person's telling a story, the innocence in the story just shines through because there's a difference between telling a story when you're guilty and trying to, you know, arrange it to fit you as opposed to...
Esteban... I don't know. Let me clarify that because we don't have too much time here, and I want to get, okay, I want to squeeze the information out of you that I think you can share with us that we're not going to be able to get from another source. You worked with people when you were in federal custody as they passed through on bench warrants, right?
Right. Or to the death, unit.
Okay, death unit. Were you able to work in the law library with people on a state unit? And what years were you there?
Well, I hit the Coalfield unit in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much stayed there on and off until 1985.
And at that time, death row was on the Ellis unit.
Right.
Okay.
And so I made quite a few units, and I, you know, would bump into, you know, people that were coming in, you know, to be on death row right there at the
diagnostic. Sure.
Back in the day when they used to, you know, hose you down, and I don't know if they still do that or not. But
No, it's all different. In the front. Now, you and I experienced the same thing coming in, but that's
70s. And the first thing you would hear is, you know, everybody move out of the way, the dead man walking, you know.
Yeah.
And just the whole scenario is, it just takes you back. You know, you're just, you know, you feel so lucky that you're in there for something else and not going to death row, because these guys, they have it really bad. The minute they get there, they have it bad. And, you know, to sit on death row for 15, 20, 30 years, you know, and then finally being exonerated, there's no way that you can make that up to a person. No way whatsoever.
Now, while you were in general population, and I hope you don't mind my sharing some confidence, basically Esteban's problems have circled around guns, but you've never killed anybody, right?
No, sir, I never did.
But you did time with people that did.
Yes, I did. Tom Lester Pugh was a murderer, and, you know, he had a lovely character. He was a lovely man, but he was a killer, and he would admit, you know, and, you know, to anybody that he was a killer.
Yeah, well,
so there's a big difference between a person who admits that he's a killer as a person who admits that they're innocent and continue to maintain that till their death.
But relatively few people that kill go to death row, right?
Right. Very few.
Very few. As a matter of fact, you and I was in a room full of people. And
absolutely.
Yesterday, and only one of them had been on death row, and he went twice, still survived. And I was in a room where the instructor told me about all except a couple of these guys are doing time for gang-related homicides.
Right.
So it's a pretty tough crowd, you know, and you can tell from the tattoos on their face and the teardrops at the corner of their eye, which people accumulate and understand you've got to earn that sort of thing. But you encounter a lot of people who have committed homicides, some of them ugly, nasty, terrible things, but they don't make it to death row.
Exactly.
How do you explain that to people on the outside?
That's the system, okay? I have a nephew who was murdered here just last year. To this day, they have yet to find who exactly murdered him. The murder was horrific. They kidnapped him at a party, threw him in a trunk of a car, took his truck and followed him out to the river bottom and beat him up, robbed him, shot him twice in the head, put him in a truck, torched him, and took his burnt body and went and dumped it 2 miles down the road. Now, somebody to do that to another person, okay, that's a horrific thing. And my first reaction was I wanted to get revenge. But as time, you know, passed, I realized that revenge is not what we need. What we need is understanding and compassion. Because if we continue to seek revenge, then we'll just be like everybody else. And we will never stop killing. We will continue to fight other countries. We will continue to kill other people. We will continue to execute our own social mistakes, because that's what they are. Okay? We don't want to take blame for our social responsibilities, so we execute them. The judicial system's not, you know, about to admit that they've committed a wrong. That's the last thing they want to do. So they continue to uphold the death penalty just because they don't want to be wrong. They don't want to, you know, be told that, look, this problem began with you guys, with the special interest groups, with the money being pumped into our society to bolster filth and trash out there in our society for, you know, our minds to get all warped with all the garbage that the interest groups put out there and our government allows to exist. And so we've basically created our little own Babylon, and we don't know what to do with it. Okay, so we continue to execute and kill what we don't like or don't understand or don't want to take the time to fix.
So execution is a liberal, tolerant thing?
Absolutely. If we did not want people executed in this country, we wouldn't have them. But there's too many people out there that they quench their thirst by doing this, because it takes the light away from the real problem. And the real problem is that our government isn't representing us the way it should be. And it's not doing what it should do to keep our society in check.
Esteban, I am sorry, but the clock is God, and the clock tells me I've got to do a billboard and get out of this radio program. How do people get in touch with you?
I am located at TWWA Inc., and that Inc. is spelled I-N-K, because this is the book distribution center for the United States Jailhouse Lawyer. The address is 3221 Franklin Avenue, Suite 204, Waco, Texas, 76710.
And on the web?
And on the web, it's twwalaw@yahoo.com.
Thank you, Esteban Garcia. We appreciate you coming in. Next time, join us earlier, and we can have a longer conversation.
Thank you, Ray, so much.
Okay.
Say hello to everybody for me over there at KPFB.
I'll tell the crew Friday that you send your love.
Okay. Good night. And y'all keep up the good work, Ray.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
That was Esteban Garcia. He's had some experience of being a jailhouse lawyer, and he put out a jailhouse lawyer's handbook. You can get information about that at the addresses that he gave. If you missed them, you can go back and play this on replay and pick those up. Esteban is a frequent guest on The Prison Show on Friday nights on KPFT. My name is Ray Hill. The name of the show is Execution Watch. You can get it on executionwatch.org, or you may even be listening to it on KPFT Houston HD2 channel. Tonight we've had Robert Rosenberg in our conversation, Esteban Garcia. We talked with Dennis Longmire from Huntsville Vigil. We talked to Darnie Perez from St. Ignatius Martyr Catholic Church in Austin. We couldn't do this program if we didn't have the expertise and the help of Otis McClay, who is our wizard, who keeps the electronics together so that we can do it. Our producer, executive producer, is Elizabeth Ann Stein. And Elizabeth is also a member of the staff of The Prison Show. To communicate with us, you can go to executionwatch.org. Thank you very much, and good night from this show and this radio station.